Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
Hey, this is YD from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, did I tell you guys I got a goat?
Gravity was the first force to be understood scientifically, though three more would eventually follow. And although Newton discovered his law of gravity more than 300 years ago, his equations describing this force make such accurate predictions that we still make use of them today.
In fact, scientists needed nothing more than Newton's equations to plot the course of a rocket that landed men on the moon. Yet, there was a problem. While his laws described the strength of gravity with great accuracy, Newton was harboring an embarrassing secret. He had no idea how gravity actually works.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
I have a theory about that. Good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity. Hey, I said gravity. Painkillers, Subarus, the ARA San Juan, politics, and or the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. Well, the laws of gravity are immutable. They cannot be broken or even bent. Trust me on this. The end result of trying is being placed on opioid painkillers. Which, of course, raises questions about all that again. We did buy a new car in Svensk Superbil. The ARA San Juan has been found. Way more questions than there are answers now. Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email, Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and your preferred non-denominational web search engine. We got a new motto, Ego Bierbi Capulus ut Ali Vivere. I drink coffee that others might live. Welcome aboard, my friends. It's good to be back. So, yeah. It was, I had stayed up late Wednesday night. You got to understand this. I had stayed up very late on Wednesday night getting ready for the show on Thursday. Thursday was going to be Constitution Thursday, as usual. And I had a topic that I thought was particularly interesting and particularly in an interesting way, I thought. Now I'm not so sure, but back then I was thinking, this is going to be great. But it required extra effort and it required a good deal of study and a good deal of research and a good deal of conversation with Pat the lawyer about whether or not there's some audio that I want to use for it, but I'm still not sure, Pat. Here it is, how many days later, and I'm still not sure if I want to use it. So I'd stayed up really late working on that. Got up the next morning, and everything was normal, did my blood sugars, picked up Ben's blankets, headed out the door. I'd left my coffee cup on the desk the night before, and I headed out and headed down the stairs. And I guess for months, I don't know why Ben does this. I really don't, but he has to have his blankets down. So it's not cold, but it's just a comfort thing. He loves his blankets. But he can't carry them all. So he has to have all five of them. Five. So I usually end up carrying one or two of them. Anyway, I was carrying the one downstairs and I don't know. I guess I just missed a step or tripped on the blanket. Something went wrong. And about two steps from the bottom, all of a sudden, I found myself literally waving my arms in the air like a cartoon character thinking, oh, this will help. And I keep looking at it and I keep watching what I did. This is what it's supposed to look like. So I come out my office door here. I turn right, grab the rail, which I didn't do because I had a blanket in the coffee cup. And then you go down the stairs really gently, really slowly, because I never rush down the stairs. I'm not on a submarine anymore. Turn to the right and go to the kitchen, which is off to the right there. behind that, but this is where I ended up instead. So I guess, I'm not really sure how, but I guess somehow or another I hit the wall to the left and then twisted like 180 degrees somehow or another and ended up landing on my right side very hard. As I was going down, the knee, the right knee bent 130 degrees. Basically, it bent as far as your knee can go, which on the which, you know, again, is a good thing. That's the knee that was replaced surgically. And I've had, you know, mobility problems with it. And you could, as I was falling, you could hear it going as it, as the adhesions were breaking up. And it, of course, it hurt, hit the ground. In the split second, in the instant I hit the ground, I thought, oh man, I've torn up the knee implant. And then my head hit the ground on my right side. I hit the, my head hit the ground very hard. And then I thought, great, now I'm concussed. And then I kind of rolled over and sat there for a second. The coffee cup was empty, amazingly enough. It didn't break. That's the thing that's really amazing. My coffee cup did not break, which says something for Navy coffee cups, because that's a Navy coffee cup. But anyway, I ended up on my back and just kind of laying there for a few minutes because my knee was just killing me. And my head was kind of ringing a little bit, you know, from the impact and the on the ground there. And so I was just laying there, not even thinking about my arm or shoulder. I didn't feel anything in my arm or shoulder. And it kind of harkens back to when I shattered my hand. Same sort of thing happened. When I hit the ice, I thought I'd torn up my knee again. My knee was just killing me. And it wasn't until I got to the bench that I realized there was anything wrong with my hand. So I'm laying there on the ground. And after a few minutes, I called for Ben because Ben knows how to use my phone, so he could call, you know, my wife if we needed to or whatever. He comes in here, he grabs my phone, and of course, immediately takes that picture. So that's kids nowadays, I guess. He immediately takes this picture of me lying on the ground so he can text it to mom if he needs to. Anyway, and I started to sit up. I tried to sit up, and as I pushed off, because I'm right-handed, so I pushed off with my right arm, and holy crap. Holy cow. I mean, that was just wasn't the most painful thing ever, but it was up there. And the upshot of it was, is I finally managed to get up on my other side, put my hand on top of my shoulder, and I had about an inch knot on the top of my shoulder. Thought, oh my God, my hand was going numb. I thought, this is broken. Anyway, long story short, I got to the couch and got sat down. We finally got a hold of my wife, who wasn't answering her phone, because why have all these phones if you're not going to answer them, right? I mean, that's my biggest frustration with cell phones, is we got them because we want communication, but we really don't. And so nobody ever answers them. Anyway, we finally got a hold of her at the hospital. She came home, ended up in the emergency room. They did x-rays on my shoulder. The x-rays surprisingly were negative, and I was really surprised by that. Especially given the amount of pain, what was going on. The doctor there, the emergency room doctor, said, I think what probably happened is you probably dislocated it, and then when you tried to get up, it popped back in. But it tore the rotator cuff. And of course, subsequent to that, that's what this is looking like. They did do a CT scan because they were quite worried about my head, and it was completely clear. So I don't know what to make of that other than I hit my head hard, folks. I mean, hard. That may be one of the hardest jolts I've ever taken to my head, and nothing. So either I have a really hard head, or maybe that carpet. So that's the other thing I'm thinking, is maybe that carpet kind of helped, because that's about where I hit. So maybe that was a little bit of protection. Who knows? Anyway, I survived that. And of course, the beauty of this was, then when you leave the hospital, they give you hydrocodone, Vicodin, and now I'm on opioids. Just a reminder, 25,000 people die every year from falling. Congress doesn't do anything about it. Gravity should be outlawed, right? It's kind of intended as a funny, but it's also serious. People do die from falls every day. It's bizarre to me, but it's true. And then I realize, a couple of days later, having laid on that floor for a while and having been on this Vicodin for a couple of days, how lucky I really was that this wasn't worse, that that it wasn't as bad as it could have been. Even if you take the shoulder and the head out of it, I mean, it's possible that I could have wrenched the knee back out. I could have broken bones. There's all kinds of stuff that could have happened, and I guess we're lucky that it didn't happen. But at the same time, I'm still in a great deal of pain. My right shoulder, this one, is very, very sore, and you can feel, well, you can't feel it, but I can. Just putting my hand on it like that is painful. There's a great deal of muscle issues with it. Every time I move my hand, and of course I'm right-handed, so moving everything, I can kind of prop my hand, my arm up here on the desk, and then move the mouse with my wrist and my hand and not have to move the shoulder, but you'd be amazed at what you have to use your shoulder to do. One of the things you have to use your shoulder to do, and I don't know if you knew this or not, but these kid-proof bottles of pills, remember, you have to shove down on that and twist and in both directions, and boy, does that hurt when your shoulder's messed up. So it really got hosed up. So, but I feel better, I guess. I don't really feel better because number one, I'm on Vicodin, which Vicodin is, it's very effective on me. My wife would tell you that I'm a very, very lightweight when it comes to painkilling drugs. And I guess in a way I am. And I'm actually kind of thankful for that. Vicodin usually will kill pain pretty quick for me, but it also has the side effects that opioid painkillers have. It puts me to sleep pretty badly. In fact, Friday, the day after this happened, I had to go to a meeting in the early afternoon. I couldn't get out of it. And after that meeting, I got back. I walked in the door. My wife and my daughter were here, and I just said, "Nice to see you. I love you guys." I was in so much pain. I took a Vicodin, and 20 minutes later, I was out, and I slept for about 3 hours. I try not to take them, not because I'm afraid of being addicted to them, but because I understand pain management to the degree that, you know, if I'm trying to do something that I need to be pain-free for, that's one thing. But if I'm not, like right now, I mean, I hurt, but do I need to be pain-free right now? Not really. And so I look at these opioids as right now, and is unnecessary. I did take some ibuprofen, a lot of ibuprofen, probably more than the recommended dose, but you know, I needed to stop hurting. So, but it doesn't. And so as long as I don't move it, it's all right. Ben was really scared. Cammy was concerned. I didn't even know my other daughter was home. It was kind of weird because I was laying at the bottom of the stairs screaming and she didn't come out of her room. So I just assumed she wasn't here. It turns out she was. She was just asleep with headphones on. So, but again, overall, fairly lucky. The opioid thing always concerns me. I don't know. I got in a big discussion with Tim Price over the weekend about this because of the issues with opioids. And of course, we run PSAs about opioids, and I've had conversations with people about these. It's remarkable to me the level of this. Now, I'm told, according to this, that 52,000 plus people die of drug overdoses, opioid drug overdoses. I'm not sure I believe that. I really don't. 52,000 drug overdoses, yeah, many of which are opioids, that's fine. But the problem with it is that this, two-thirds of them are opioid. But the problem with this is that the overreaction to it in some ways is concerning to me. Now, you could get into the whole thing about, well, you know, guns kill X number of people, so we're trying to get rid of guns, and they don't kill nearly as many people as opioids do. Well, so, but we are trying to secure opioids as well, which is weird to me because they work. They work really well. And this is the second time I've had to go through this where I get a prescription for these things, and I can't get the prescription filled because the pharmacies don't want to fill them because they're afraid that I might get addicted to it, I guess. I don't know. I've never really figured this out. I don't know what the problem is. I know that there are people addicted to opioids, but I know that there are people addicted to cocaine too. There are people addicted to alcohol. There are people addicted to sex. There are people addicted to nicotine and all these kinds of things. But somehow or another, when it comes to this opioid painkillers, we've got to create all kinds of strange, in my view, methods of trying to prevent this because somehow or another, this is worse than everything else. And I'm not sure that opioid painkillers are just like anything else. Used properly, they are very helpful. Believe me, I wouldn't be sitting here right now if it wasn't for them. If I couldn't sleep at all because of the pain, there's no way I could get up in the morning and do the things that I normally do. And, you know, maybe that's a sign. I don't know. But at the same time, there's this resistance to them that is beyond the norm, in my view. And it's something that I want to explore much deeper. It's something that I really want to sit down with. Tim and I, like I said, had an interesting conversation about it over the weekend, but it was in between everything else. We really weren't able to get into depth and start analyzing because I really question this hatred of opioid painkillers. Are they potentially dangerous? Absolutely they are. But so are cars and so are stairs. You know, people aren't calling to ban stairs, and yet 25,000 people a year are dying because of falls and the likes of that. We lost a person that listens to this show. They used to listen to this show on a regular basis. We lost her a couple of years after a fall. It's a little unnerving, I guess. I who knows, but it's something that I want to look at a lot deeper on another day when we have time to really analyze the theories and the thoughts behind the opioid crisis. So after we got done with the emergency room, which was an adventure, the emergency room is always an adventure. It really is. I mean, it's one of those things where you go to it and you got to go to the emergency room with the attitude, if I'm going to be here minimum of 4 hours, no matter what's wrong, no matter how many people are there, it's going to take a minimum of 4 hours. And that's about what it took. We got in there, they do all the vital signs. So my brain was kind of, I was in a lot of pain, and the nurse says to me, "How high were you?" And I said, I looked at her funny, and I said, "I wasn't high at all. It was, I just hadn't had any coffee yet." And she starts laughing. She said, "No, I mean on the stairs. How high were you up on the stairs?" And I think I was about two stairs up from the bottom, but I don't even know for sure. I really don't. Upshot of it all is they got me in there. They rolled me around, dude, x-rays and CT scans. The CT scan was fascinating. I'd never had one of those before. Little like an MRI, but without the tube. The doctor was really nice. The nurse was really great. The technician was fantastic. Get it all done. And at the end of it, really spent 4 hours in the hospital for a Vicodin tablet and prescription and go home and make an appointment with your regular doctor to have it looked at. Of course, my regular doctor doesn't work on Fridays, so can't make that appointment until today, and it'll probably be 2 weeks from now, and who knows where we'll be from there. Now, the big issue with Friday, of course, was Cammie bought a new car. I think we briefly talked about this. Cammie had bought a new car, and we had to go do all the paperwork on Friday afternoon. That was the original plan. She got off work. She's going to come home, rest a little bit, and then we were going to go in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. Sign off all the stuff for the car. Well, she still wants to do this, and I still have to go because we need both signatures. So we walk into the Subaru dealership at 2 o'clock. This is the car that she bought, the Subaru Ascent. And this pretty much is the car she bought. This is the Swedish supercar. I don't know how this happened. I really don't. We walked in there with the idea of building a car for us, getting it built and brought out. And it was about, $38,000-$39,000. And it's the car she wants. I mean, it's a nice car and don't judge or anything. I mean, she's earned it. So this is the car she really wants. And somehow or another, I don't know how cars place sales places are. I had to leave at one point for some other reasons. And by the time I got back, we were signing off on a much more expensive car than that, but Cammie got her Subaru, and I think we pick it up today. Today is Monday. I believe we pick it up today. They had to bring it in from another dealer, and they were going to shine it up and buff it up and put some stuff in it and on it and all that kind of stuff. And then it's supposed to be ready either late today or tomorrow, early tomorrow. And of course, today would be better because then we could go play with our supercar, but in the meantime, there you go. So we bought a Subaru, which Cammy is very happy about. Cammy has wanted a Subaru from the day I met her. She has wanted a Subaru. And from the day we got married, she's talked about, I want a Subaru. When we bought the Chevy, when we bought the Cruze as our second car, she wasn't really happy about that because she really wanted a Subaru. But at the time, the Chevy Cruze made a lot more sense for us. And literally from the day we got it and got it paid off, she's been like, I want a Subaru. I want a Subaru. And she wanted the Ascent. She wanted, that's the brand new one. That's the brand new. This car has technology on top of technology. This car has freaking eight or nine USB ports throughout the thing, USB charging ports. It has, you know, satellite navigation. It's got, I mean, anything technology you can imagine. These four tires, it's all-wheel drive. And this is the thing that freaked me out was these all-wheel drive cars. Did you know that if you blow a tire, if you damage a tire, one tire on a four-wheel, on an all-wheel drive car, you have to replace all four tires. At least that's what they tell you. And they, of course, sell you an insurance policy so that, you know, 7-year insurance policy. So that if we blow a tire, they'll replace them all, which is probably how this car got more expensive, is all the little add-on stuff that they nail you with, right? It's got to be. Who knows? Anyway, we got a new car, and now we got to figure out what to do with the old car. I'm sure we'll kick it down to kids or something like that. I'm not getting rid of my truck. I love my truck. I love my truck. I love my little Colorado that I bought all those years ago. And I don't particularly want to get rid of it. I do want to get rid of that stupid Chevy passcode lock system. That's for sure. But I don't want to, get rid of the truck. And now I'm not going to, because we're going to be paying on this Subaru for the next 7 years, I guess, 6 years, 5 years. It's a ton of money on that thing. So long story short, I fell going down the stairs like this, like I said a few minutes ago, and turn right and go down there. And somehow I just missed those last two stairs and ended up, you know, on my side, tearing a rotator cuff, banging my head, and helping my knee. I guess that's the most remarkable thing about all this, is that for all of that, my right knee is actually better now. I mean, it is moving in ways that it couldn't move before that fall. So I guess, you know, it's one of those things you look at it, you go, well, okay, I fell, I hurt myself really badly, but my knee is better. Is that good? I think so in some ways. I mean, a shoulder's eventually going to heal. They are going to, I guess the plan at this point is wait till the swelling goes down and then do MRI or something, which I'm not looking forward to, an MRI. I do not like MRIs. I don't like being stuffed in that tube. I don't like it. And so even the open MRI is not open. And I'll tell you the freakiest thing about it for MRI for me. It's not the claustrophobia. It's the vision. Because my eyesight is so messed up, when I'm looking at the, and that tube is so close, you can't wear your glasses in there and I can't focus on anything and there's nothing to focus on. And so it just messes with my vision. I'd be better off if they just blindfolded me and put me in there, but they won't. So anyway, that's why I don't like MRIs. So they'll do that. And then it's possible, I guess, that surgery might be in the future for the shoulder, but who knows? Based on how it feels right now, I would say it's probably not. It's probably just something I'll just have to live with pain-wise for a while. And because eventually, I mean, I'm getting more and more motion back. Still kind of hurts lifting right there, but we'll see what happens. All right. Thank you for all the thoughts, prayers, text messages. I got hundreds of those. I got all kinds of stuff. People, you know, Dave, you all right? Mojav texted me, hey, you okay? If feed hasn't updated for a couple of days, because it's like, man, it was not easy, but we got through it. So everything's fine for the moment. Everything's okay. The only thing I can say is be careful going downstairs. Don't take things for granted. And if you do, be careful, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening, and gravity always wins. There's nothing you can do to defeat gravity. It is like the superhero, evil superhero of the entire universe. Gravity always wins. Always. Believe me, I'm feeling every bit of it today. Every bit of it in the broad spectrum. So, other stuff happened over the weekend that I didn't really get to. The Broncos won. Hooray! The Chargers' reaction to that is even more funny. The Cowboys won. That was exciting. They were down 13 points with 8 minutes to go, and they end up winning the game. So that was exciting. NFL had a decent weekend, and it looks like attendance is coming back, which is what I've said all along. The problem with the NFL wasn't the protest. The problem with the NFL was the quality of the game. That's improving. Even the Raiders won. That's pretty amazing, too. And then, of course, the news came out over the weekend that they had found the wreckage of the ARA San Juan. It's good that they found her. The theory is that now we can get some answers. The theory is now things can be determined, things can be figured out. I'm not sure that that's the case, and I know the family is really, really upset about some things already. I mean, it hasn't been 72 hours since they found her or announced it, but the family is already angry about a lot of things. We'll talk about some of that stuff here in just a moment. It is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network, here most weekdays. You know, stuff doesn't happen. Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific. Obviously, this week is Thanksgiving, so we won't be here Thursday and Friday. But for now, weekdays, 10 a.m., right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Stay with us. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back right after this.
Listening to the Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
I'm sitting here watching highlights from yesterday, and I'm watching players land on their shoulders similar to the way I did, and they get up, and I realize they're wearing shoulder pads and all, but I don't know that that would help that much. I really don't. Pretty exciting stuff, though. Looks like it would hurt to me. Sure it would have hurt me. Welcome back. It's the Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You want to get a hold of me, area code 209-565-DAVE. Email is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for the Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes. If you download the show, leave us a rating and a review. We'd appreciate it. And at thedavebowmanshow.com as well as podcast99.org. Alex was talking about there in the news about the Medal of Freedom ceremony. Have you? I don't know if you've ever been to one of these. I had the honor some years ago, 1995 actually, of being invited to one of these ceremonies. There was a long reason why they were doing it in Warm Springs, Georgia, at the Southern White House, where President Roosevelt had passed away. It was the 40th or 50th anniversary of that. I guess it was the 40th then. And so they wanted to do it there. And Bill Clinton was in the White House then. And there were people who knew me, who understood that I was involved with certain things. And they needed a certain type of musician for this kind of thing. And so they asked me if I knew anybody. And of course I did. So I was able to get that person to this thing to recreate the atmosphere at the Southern White House, the Warm Springs, Georgia. And as a part of that, I got invited to this. And so we actually went to a special luncheon where the president was, President Clinton, and we got to sit in the front VIP section and meet a lot of these recipients. Now, as I recall, I could go back and look it up, but the recipients were Jimmy Carter was one of them for his things, and Bill Clinton was the presenter. The way these medals of freedom are done is, you know, there's they're not, how do I say this? They aren't exactly political awards, but they're not exactly, you know, you really did something worthwhile either. I mean, that's part of the whole thing with it. It's kind of a, I don't know. It always has this sense to it that it's the president picking out people that he really likes. It's the people that he really, you know, wants to have these things and the likes of that. But I remember Jimmy Carter being one of the recipients there. I'd have to go back and look at who the others were, but Bill Clinton was the president then. And the remarkable thing about it to me was meeting President Carter or President Clinton. He's very short. I don't know if you know, he's very small. He's tiny. You don't get that. And maybe this is my perspective as a guy who's rather rotund, I guess. Maybe my perspective is a little weird in this, but he's small. Number one, he's shorter than he looks on camera. He really is. And number two, he's very, I mean, you just feel like you could just pick him up and throw him. He's not very big. I was very surprised by that, but he is a very gregarious guy. I've said this for years. Whether I agree with him politically or not is irrelevant. He's one of those guys that if you were going to have a barbecue, you'd want to invite him. He's a nice guy. He has a way of being in the room and making you feel like you're the only one talking to him. He really has that Southern charm to him. So I'd gone to this, and so I'd been to one of these things before, and I don't pay a lot of attention to them because, let's face it, they're a little, like I said, they're not self-serving. There are criteria for these awards, but they're not, you know, they're not the Congressional Medal of Honor. President Trump had his Medal of Freedom ceremony over the weekend. Babe Ruth got one. I was stunned by that. When I saw Babe Ruth got a Medal of Freedom, I couldn't believe for the life of me that Babe Ruth hadn't already gotten one. That's strange to me that Babe Ruth, the baseball icon in America, didn't get one. Roger Staubach getting one. I think that's appropriate. Roger Staubach is an American icon and an American hero. Went to the Naval Academy, won the Heisman Trophy, went to Vietnam, served his country, then came back and played football. Alan Page, of course, a great football star. Then you get into these other ones. Orrin Hatch gets a Medal of Freedom. Again, for what? I'm not. Each one of these, Miriam Adelson, people are upset about this. Well, all she did was marry a billionaire who supported Trump. Yeah, she's also a doctor and a philanthropist and those kind of things. She has her own curriculum vitae, so there's no, but that doesn't stop people from hammering it. And then you have, you know, Antonin Scalia, probably deserving of one. I don't have a problem with that. The one that's really got people upset, are you ready for this? The one that really has people complaining about Trump's Medal of Freedom presentation isn't Scalia. It isn't Adelson. It isn't Orrin Hatch. Certainly not Roger Staubach or Babe Ruth, although those should have happened, in my view, a long time ago. You know the one that's really got people's jaws flapping on social media and whining and complaining about this? The one that's racist. Which one of the seven is racist? Well, okay, and here's the list. Okay, you ready? Babe Ruth, Antonin Scalia, Miriam Adelson, Orrin Hatch, Alan Page, Roger Staubach, and Elvis Presley. Which one of those do you think is being condemned today as a racist presentation? That's right. Elvis freaking Presley is being, the Medal of Freedom is being complained about for Elvis Presley because he was known as, quote, the king of rock and roll. The king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, Bubba Hotep, as I like to refer to him. This is actually being called racist. Why, you may be screaming? Yes, Trump sent a message here, wrote Chris Richards, a pop culture critic. A little nod to the good old days, back when black visionaries could invent rock and roll, but only a white man could become the king. We live in a country, and it's, you know, I gotta be, I don't know. There's a part of me here that's a little, because my brain is still operating on the show I had prepped for Thursday, which deals with these issues of racism and the way our country has handled them and reacted to them and what that's caused today. And so I've been kind of focused on a lot of that lately. And you know, Elvis Presley's been dead for 40 years. Elvis Presley hadn't been the king of rock and roll for 40 years. But somehow or another, giving his dry, desiccated, dissolved corpse a Medal of Freedom for his contributions to American culture and American virtues is now being seen as racist because he was the king of rock and roll because, you know, white people stole black music and made it their own. It's almost as if we're trying to find racism wherever we can find it. It's almost like we're making up places to find racism. It's almost as if anything and everything can be racist. You wonder how we're ever going to get anything done? Elvis Presley, Medal of Freedom, being all those people, Miriam Adelson, Antonin Scalia, people that the left hates, okay, Orrin Hatch. But the one they focus on is Elvis Presley. Elvis freaking Presley. Can't make that up, folks. You just can't. It's almost like a Democrat congresswoman talking about the three branches of Congress. Can't make that stuff up. Sometimes you think you should, but you can't. The other big news over the weekend, of course, was the discovery of the lost submarine, the ARA San Juan, the Argentine submarine San Juan. Of course, this hits home to me in a lot of ways. The ARA San Juan was a unique, well, it wasn't unique, but it was an interesting submarine in a lot of ways. Number one, you don't really think about Argentina as a military or naval power, particularly after 1982. But these are a lot of brave men, and in this case, women, who go to sea to do things that, you know, frankly, have to be done, that navies have to do. In our case, we use the Coast Guard more for the missions that the Navy was involved with there. But the ARA San Juan was, let's face it, we talked about this back at the time, she was in bad shape. And the idea that she would be sent to sea in that condition is a little unnerving. Disappeared almost a year to the day. There was a lot of speculation at the time about what could have happened, what did happen, why it happened, how it happened, whose fault was it, and we didn't know anything. We did not know nothing. And yet, people were speculating about what had happened. There was a lot of discussion about the acoustical data that indicated that there might have been an explosion or an implosion event. And the one thing that was clear was that they weren't coming back. I think we all knew that early on, particularly those of us that are professional submariners. We all knew that, but you want to hold out hope. You want to say, okay, maybe there's a chance. But as time slipped by, it became clear, more and more clear, that there was no chance. And so over the weekend, they announced that they did find her relatively within the area that her final GPS fix was taken, and then just a little bit north as she would have traveled, they found the wreckage. You can see there from the seaboard floor that this is not an easy area to search. There's apparently a lot of underwater topography that made things very difficult, made things very easy, very suspect, very hard to do. The ship that was searching for them was searching on a find or don't get paid contract. And this was literally the last target they had time to look for the contact. And of course it turned out to be it because, I don't know, somehow or another things always turn out to be in the last place you look for them. They found it. They have released some photos, and these photos are fascinating to me, but again, they are an incomplete picture of what's going on. So you're kind of looking at the bow section here. It's unclear to me which direction we're looking. Are we looking at the bottom, which is what I suspect? Or are we looking at the top, which is what I don't suspect? But that's, again, that's my speculation. There's some reasons why I think that. the tubes on these ships are more towards the base, the bottom line, than they are towards the top. So there's some things here that interest me on this picture, and we'll come back to them in just a minute. They also released this photograph of the screw, which obviously had been ejected from the ship. This is not unusual when a ship implodes, not unusual at all. And could really, I mean, it's just kind of a fascinating picture. It doesn't really tell us anything. Then there's this photograph of the sail, which is laying on its side. There are people who are immediately jumping on. Well, look, the plane is, it's on its side. So you're looking at the front towards the back of it on its side. The sail plane is in a weird angle, and people are making some of that. You can't really make anything of that, because once the ship implodes, you're dealing with, a loss of hydraulics. Who knows what happens? Who knows where goes where? And so this is a schematic of what you're looking at. The forward, the red circle there is a sonar thing. The same with blue, and then the white circle is around the sail planes. And you kind of get a schematic there. The black tube towards the right is the trunk that leads up. That's the way people get up and down from the sail. Over to the left is the far left there is the induction mast. Snorkel mast is what we would call it, with the induction system, and that's where they bring in air into the submarine. And so, given the limited release of information that we have here, the limited release of photos, it's hard to really make any conclusions, and anything I say here is just pure speculation. You need to understand that above all else. This is pure speculation, because we just don't know. The family wants Argentina to raise the submarine. Now, the submarine is roughly 2,900 feet underwater in very difficult, again, topography. It appears to be in pieces, which means that how do you raise this thing? It's not, this is not easy to do. This thing is not, it's not the Kursk in 300 feet of water. It's not, this is not an easy salvage. Even when the United States raised a Russian submarine from 12, 13,000 feet down, they did it with, it took a lot of technology to do that. And they, depending on who you look at, they were only marginally successful. So raising something like this it's inherently difficult, and it's also really not necessary. But the families are very upset about this, and they want this race. So this particular picture here, this is the first one I showed you, this of the tubes, is intriguing to me because it shows some things that are indicative, I guess, of what may have happened. Number one, you can see from this that these tubes are extended out, okay, that they extend. That is not their normal position relative to the hull. So just a guess here, maybe a foot and a half out of the hull there. That is normally covered by fairwater. It's very normally covered by a hull piece that makes the, because you can see where the ship is going, that's the forward end of the ship, so it would be going that way. You can see where that would be resistive and it would make noise. So normally those are covered by fairwater hull or free flood hull that would reduce that friction and that noise. That piece, whatever that piece is supposed to be gone, is gone there, and you can see the hydraulic cables there that opened and shut the torpedo tubes doors. That piece is gone. Now, if what we suspect happened, that probably would have happened when it hit the bottom, not as part of the explosion or the implosion. Although it's possible, you just don't know. These are things that, again, this is just guesswork at this point. We're told, and you kind of get a sense of it there, that the hull, the forward hull, is intact, or more intact than the after hull, which would mean that it was probably or possibly flooded prior to the implosion, and only half the submarine imploded, the after half. Who knows? But it's a little unnerving to look at that. Clearly, the after half of the submarine is just demolished, which would be consistent with an implosion. And the sail ripped off as the submarine both imploded and hit the bottom at probably a pretty significant rate. Who knows? And that's how you get all this mess junk thrown out there. These are the only pictures they've released to us so far. They haven't given us much else to go on. And ultimately, whether or not we determine what actually happened or not really depends on how much of the hull is intact and what you can determine. But Argentina, I guess, announced the other day that they suspect that the induction valve was in the wrong position, which would mean crew error. The families immediately went ballistic. You can't say that about our loved ones. Our loved ones would never make such a mistake, which, of course, is pure emotionalism because people make mistakes. That's what kills ships usually, is people make mistakes. So while I agree that it was probably premature to say that, at the same time, the families are kind of reacting out of emotion rather than logic, and they're not really willing to accept the fact that maybe there was an accident, maybe somebody did something wrong, and that's got them a little upset. And I get that. I understand it. But at the same time, it doesn't help us get to the what actually happened approach to this. We know that they had electrical problems because they had talked about those. We knew that they had had some real issues with the issue with the operation of the boat, and they were having those problems. And I think I still go back to my original scenario, which is they were probably running on reduced electrical, which means that they were snorkeling near the surface, trying to keep the electricity going. And something went wrong in the head valve and the induction valve. It's hard to imagine because these things are designed to fail shut, so that if they lose electrical or hydraulic power, they slam shut to keep the ship from sinking. But you never know. Once electricity starts being fritzy, you never know what it's going to do. That's the one thing I learned about electricity a long time ago. You know, circuits and stuff like that is it's easy to say they're supposed to operate a certain way, but those certain ways are usually designed for either on or off. And if there's anything in between, you just never know what's going to happen. What do you mean in between, Dave? Well, most power on a submarine is three-phase power. It's either AC or DC, but AC power is almost completely three-phase power, meaning there's three phases of the 120 or 440. If you drop one phase of it, you still have the 120 or the 440 voltage, but you don't have a phase of it, and so you don't have full power, and weird stuff starts happening. I can tell you that from experience. Weird things start happening. And what happens if they had some sort of short, some sort of system, some sort of failure that didn't completely shut off electrical, but didn't give it full power? And, you know, who knows what ends up happening? And, you know, the likely scenario that they start flooding while snorkeling, and then that leads to other problems. Maybe the ship gets secured. Maybe the ship is flooding. Who knows? The only way they're going to find out is by an extensive investigation of the wreck. Don't think they're going to be able to raise it. I don't think they're going to be able to bring that thing up. Sure, it'd be interesting if they did, like the Kursk, but I don't know what you're going to find a year after. You're not going to find any bodies. But that would seem unlikely. Certainly no bodies from the implosion section, but maybe in the flooded section, who knows? But the likelihood of it is that you don't really want to. We've had a lot of discussion on this on submarine boards and the fact that if my submarine had gone down, what would I have wanted? Just leave me there. Just leave us alone. This is where we wanted to be. This is who we wanted to be. This is what we wanted to be. Just leave us alone. You know, mourn us. Learn from us if you can. Do the forensics investigations, whatever you can, to figure out what's going on. But as a general rule, just leave us alone would have been our thought. And I have to imagine that they probably fell the same way. Feel the same way. These were men and women who fought hard to bring their boat home and didn't make it. And we can speculate until we're blue in the face about why they didn't make it. We can comment. We can guess. We can argue. We can debate. But at the end of the day, they didn't make it home. Something was either too much or they made a mistake. One of the two. It was either a problem they just could not overcome, which is, you know, again, the most likely scenario, because submariners are very highly trained, very, very highly motivated, and very highly thought of to be able to handle these problems outside of the boxes. May have just been more than they could handle. There may literally have been nothing they could do. They tried everything there was. And I would prefer to think of them that way than somehow or another they just messed up. Although that's certainly a possibility. Boat shouldn't probably shouldn't have been at sea. I'm sure there's some there's not a liability, but I'm sure there's some culpability there of the fact that the boat should not have been sent on the mission that it was sent on. But those are things that come up after the fact. Those are questions that come up later. And at the end of the day, if nothing goes wrong, who knows? Nobody worries about it. It's only when things go wrong that people actually get upset. So see what happens. Anyway, God bless them, and may they rest in peace, having been found at long last. Well, I made it through. I got to be honest with you, I'm in a lot of pain. You can probably tell that I'm a little distracted and trying to deal with some issues here, some in my shoulder, but we did make it through. So tomorrow, I think we will go back and do Constitution Thursday from last week, which oddly enough is about the Bladensburg Cross. You've heard about this, the Bladensburg Cross. But it has a lot more to do with other stuff than you might think. And because I'm a conservative chat show host, I'm supposed to be screaming and yelling that they want to tear down the cross. The court said tear down the cross. That's not what they said, but, you know, who listens to that? So we'll talk about some of that, why that matters, and how we got to this point, and what we could be looking at in a potential Supreme Court ruling on that. And then Wednesday, I don't know what we'll do, but we'll figure it out. And then Thursday and Friday, of course, is Thanksgiving, so we'll enjoy family time. We're having the whole family over for that. So that'll put a wrap on the day. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very, very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman, and this is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, Monday through Fridays, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Dave Bowman Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.